Section 4. North Carolina again helps win the World War. As you read, look for reasons for our nation's entry into World War II, the contributions North Carolina made toward the war effort, the impact of World War II on North Carolina, and the following term, rationing. In 1940, a whole generation of North Carolinians had made industry, segregation, graded schools, and automobiles part of their normal lives. Hundreds of women, for example, took jobs in downtown stores and kept them for decades. Miss Julia Wheeler had been working for a bank in Hickory for 50 years. In her spare time, she had taught Hickory to type, said her boss. College graduates often held the same office job for all of their work lives. Life seemed more stable. For example, while a flood had devastated the Catawba River Valley in 1916, a similar flood was kept in check by the chain of Duke Power Dams. Where towns were flooded, city governments responded quickly. Tax money seemed more wisely spent once the Great Depression had lifted. That made state residents more in tune with international events. When their industrially based way of life was threatened, these North Carolinians were quick to do their patriotic duty, to sacrifice and fight for what they had. Going to war again. World War II, in some ways, continued the issues of the First World War. The main contenders were still the European countries, Great Britain and Germany. France and Russia were still involved. Russia, now known as the Soviet Union, switched sides during the war. What was new was the bigger role played by Japan, which wanted more influence over the countries of Asia and their natural resources. What was also new was the determination of President Roosevelt and his allies to have the United States play a more decisive role in the outcome of the war. Roosevelt particularly used federal money to produce industrial goods needed by the British and their French allies in fighting the Germans. Once the war started, Congress also took two actions that immediately impacted North Carolinians. First, it started another military draft, which put more of the state's young men in the armed services. Second, Congress extended the income tax to most Americans in order to pay for increased federal spending. In 1940, for the first time, most North Carolinians had to pay income taxes. North Carolina's mobilization. World War II officially began in Europe in September 1939 when Germany invaded Poland. President Roosevelt declared that the United States would remain neutral, but he looked for ways to help the Allies. Meanwhile, relations between the United States and Japan worsened. After Japan invaded French Indochina, today's Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia, in 1941, President Roosevelt seized all Japanese property in the United States. North Carolinians were as shocked as anyone in America when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii on December 7, 1941. Hundreds of North Carolinians were on the ships that were sunk. On December 8, the United States declared war on Japan and entered the conflict. A few days later, Germany and Italy declared war on the United States. The United States armed itself and fought a war in both Europe and Asia. North Carolinians quickly felt the brunt of the war. German submarines ambushed hundreds of ships off Cape Hatteras. Thousands of sailors joined the long tradition of being shipwrecked on the Outer Banks. The injured were treated at hospitals in Morehead City and New Bern. More than 300,000 North Carolinians, whites and blacks, men and women, served in the armed services during World War II. Unlike the Civil War, where neighborhoods sent companies to war, individual North Carolinians were put into military units with people from around the country. Thus, North Carolinians ended up fighting in every place the war was fought, from the Burma Road that crossed the Asian Mountains to the Normandy invasion of the coast of France. Some Tar Heels, like Colonel Charles M. McCorkle, whose ancestors had fought at Kings Mountain, became heroes. McCorkle, an Army Air Force flyer, shot down 5 enemy planes in a week. The Newton native chased a German plane 40 miles behind enemy lines because it had acquired valuable intelligence. McCorkle shot it down and made it back to his base, despite having the cooling system shot out of his engine. Just over 7,000 North Carolinians died while serving, about 1 in 40. This was much lower than the 1 in 3 ratio of deaths from the Civil War. Thousands more were wounded. The deaths and wounds touched every place in the state. As one official noted, no North Carolina city, no town, no rural area escaped. North Carolina became an important military training center during the war. The size of Fort Bragg swelled from 5,000 to 100,000. The artillery training ground was expanded for miles into the Sandhills and became the most comprehensive training ground in the country. A new type of fighter, the soldier who arrived by parachute, was trained at nearby Camp McCall in Scotland County. The 82nd Airborne, which after the war moved to Fort Bragg, first jumped there. To train Marines on the ground, the federal government opened Camp Lejeune in Onslow County in 1942. To prepare Marine airmen, it established Cherry Point near New Bern. Camp Butner, north of Durham, became a large infantry training ground. North Carolinians also had a key role in producing the materials used to fight the war. In particular, the textile mills made most of the fabric used by the armed services, from sheets and blankets to parachutes and tire cords. A plant at Curie Beach, just south of Wilmington, made the lead ingredient needed for gasoline for Army trucks. The mica mines near Spruce Pine supplied thin sheets of the mineral needed for electrical wires. A shipbuilding company in Wilmington made almost 400 ships for the war effort. Trees across the state were cut down to be used in the war. North Carolina cigarettes by the millions were put into ration kits for soldiers at the battlefront. Women and the War. More than in previous conflicts, World War II took North Carolina women out of the home and put them in the middle of the war mobilization effort. Female students at Lenoir Ryan College skipped class to pick cotton when there were labor shortages during harvest. Betty Baker, a student at Woman's College, quit school to become one of thousands of North Carolinians who found wartime work at the Glenn L. Martin Aircraft Factory in Baltimore, Maryland. After she saved enough money, she came back and graduated from college. She then joined the Women's Army Corps and served for the duration of the war. More than 7,000 women from the state served in the military. Mary Webb Nicholson of Greensboro became one of 27 female pilots in the British Royal Air Force. She was shot down and died in 1943. Even women who stayed home faced new circumstances. Peggy Edgerton's family in Goldsboro took in boarders who had moved to town to build the new Seymour Johnson Field. Some of the boarders were recent immigrants to the United States who did not speak English, let alone understand North Carolina accents. It was a time of adjustment for all concerned. Minorities and the War. Black North Carolinians served in the same manner as whites in the war, although the draft boards in some counties often shipped off soldiers in segregated buses. One black draftee in Hickory waved farewell and shouted out the bus window that he was going off to fight for you white folks. Black men who did not go into the military found jobs in Wilmington and in Norfolk, Virginia, at the shipyards. Black women moved from the rural neighborhoods to the towns by the thousands, for they could obtain work in the local factories. One, Theodosia Simpson, helped lead a strike for better conditions at the R.J. Reynolds cigarette factory in Winston-Salem. The constant coming and going of people throughout the war changed normal behavior in North Carolina. For example, members of the Lumbee community in Robeson County had stuck mostly to themselves. During the war, Lumbee often met and married people from elsewhere who had come to train or serve at Fort Bragg. Ressie Sampson, for example, married Wisconsin native Charles Larson in 1944. Sacrifices on the home front. Large numbers of North Carolinians left home during World War II. In addition to the members of the armed services, thousands went out of state to find jobs in cities like Norfolk and Baltimore. Others found work in the state's busy factories, which for the first time in 10 years were operating at full capacity. The members of paratrooper Terry Sanford's family moved from Laurinburg to work in the shipyards at Wilmington. To make use of every resource possible, the federal government imposed strict regulations about the purchase and consumption of goods. In each county, local citizens were put in charge of regulating the market. A parent could not even buy a bicycle for a child without permission because metal frames and rubber tires were made of scarce commodities. Most groceries were controlled by rationing. That is, individual families could buy only so much of any item each month. Families were issued ration books and could only use the coupons inside for buying certain amounts. Prices were controlled by the coupons, and if a family ran out of coupons before the end of the month, they had to make do with what they had. Since gasoline was needed for the war effort, it was strictly limited. People drove only when it was necessary. One North Carolinian coped by building an electric car to get to work. Its two V8 Ford starter motors were powered by two car batteries. He steered with a lever and sat in a plywood box. Families again were encouraged to plant victory gardens to raise more of their own food. The strain of war got worse in western North Carolina in 1944. The crippling disease polio struck hundreds of children in many communities, in Hickory more than any other place. Hickory officials quickly converted an old Boy Scout camp into a hospital for both white and black patients. Doctors and nurses came from all over the nation to perform the miracle of Hickory, providing new drugs and physical therapy that saved dozens of lives. One of the children treated at Hickory was Harlan Bowles, who would grow up to be state treasurer. The celebration at the end. North Carolinians welcomed the end of the war in 1945, when first the Germans surrendered in May and then the Japanese in August. State residents celebrated wherever they happened to be. Traffic clogged the downtowns of every city and town. Betty Ross Austin of Peachland in Union County went with her new boyfriend, Dominic Bruno of New York City, to the victory celebration in the square in Charlotte. They had met briefly while Bruno had trained near Monroe. He wrote Betty Ross from all over Europe and got back in time for the celebration. When he swept Betty Ross off her feet and kissed her for the first time in public, a photographer captured the moment for North Carolinians. In 2010, Betty and Dominic celebrated their 65th wedding anniversary. When the war finally ended, many changes faced North Carolina and the nation. The war particularly changed the role of women and helped attack prejudice and discrimination. Special feature, Carolina People, Billy Graham. One thing is very clear about Billy Graham. During the second half of the 20th century, he traveled to more places in the world and met more people than any other North Carolinian in history. With each person, Graham witnessed the Christian gospel. He did it before leaders of nations, to both the wealthy and the poor, and for people of every ethnic background. More than 1 million people made a religious decision about their lives because of him. He is the most famous preacher the world has known in the last 1,000 years. At the same time, Reverend Graham is the typical North Carolinian. The Mecklenburg County native carried with him the traditional values of trust, kindness, and sincerity wherever he went. Like many North Carolinians, he kept coming home, choosing to live in the North Carolina mountains almost all his adult life. He has lived with his family in Montreat at the foot of the Black Mountains for more than 50 years. While Billy was growing up in the 1920s, the Graham family ran a dairy farm just south of Charlotte. In 1934, at the age of 16, Billy and a friend went to a tent revival, a popular form of public preaching. These revivals were intended to make everyone decide to lead a better Christian life. The climax of the service was the altar call, when members of the audience were asked to come forward to commit to a more religious outlook. That night, Billy came forward. He dedicated himself to doing the same thing, preaching and changing lives. Soon, he was seen preaching on the street corners of downtown Charlotte. After graduating from Wheaton College in Illinois, Billy married Ruth and began preaching around the country. His 1949 message electrified the city of Los Angeles. Originally scheduled for 3 weeks, Graham preached every day for 8 straight weeks. the publicity from the huge revival rocketed Graham into national celebrity. Much of the fame stemmed from Graham's warm personality and his earnest attempts to have people change their minds and their habits. As even one skeptical American observed, Graham was as good a man, basically, as he had ever been in the presence of. During the 1950s and 60s, Graham drew thousands of people a night to religious services held in football stadiums, indoor arenas, and concert halls. Just as had been the custom in North Carolina, the service began with prayer and singing, then a sermon. Unlike other revivalists, Graham spoke softly, and he courteously asked people to make a commitment. Because of his national reputation as a religious leader, Graham was often asked to meet with presidents and other political leaders. He became particularly close to President Richard Nixon, who had graduated from Duke University Law School. He was embarrassed when Nixon was forced to resign in the 1970s because of the Watergate scandal. Graham was also a religious advisor to George W. Bush when the Texan was having problems in his younger years. Graham's counsel helped the son of a president change his habits and move forward to become president himself. When he returned to Charlotte to a homecoming service in 1996, he told North Carolinians then, just like he always told everyone at the end of thousands of sermons, "You come now, it is important that you come." Toward the latter years of his ministry, Graham worked hard to remind the world that everyone had to be part of the process of peace. After the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001, Graham was part of the service held at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C.